Today on Maine Calling, crime stories surge in popularity. How to write one. This weekend, established and aspiring crime writers come together in Portland to mix with kindred spirits and hone their craft. The Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance event, Maine Crime Wave, features more than 20 published crime, mystery, and suspense authors. The crime genre is seeing a surge in popularity, especially true crime stories in books, podcasts, and of course, TV shows. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we meet three participating authors and find out what kind of stories make their pulse race, how they research the tales they tell, and how they write those books you just can't put down. Have you ever tried to write a crime novel? Do you have a favorite? Join the conversation. Maine Calling is just ahead. This is Maine Calling, and I'm Jennifer Rooks. From Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to Agatha Christie to Scott Turow, crime writers have long captured the imagination of the public. And today, crime writing, both fiction and true crime, is as popular as ever. Today, we're going to hear from three authors and what drew them to stories of crime, where they turned for inspiration, and why they think it's such a popular genre. My guest today, Catherine Miles, the author of five books, including Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders, which won the 2023 Maine Literary Award for Nonfiction. Kate Flora describes herself as a recovering attorney. She's the author of 24 mystery and nonfiction books. 24, wow! Her true crime stories include Finding Amy and Death Dealer. Also with us, Cheryl Head, an author, television producer, and broadcast executive. Her new book, Time's Undoing, is based in part on her grandfather's murder at the hands of police in 1929. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you always wanted to write crime fiction, or are you a big fan? What do you want to ask these authors? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We want to note that the inspiration for today's program came from the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance upcoming Crime Wave. This weekend brings together more than 20 award-winning and best-selling crime and mystery writers to talk about their craft. This is from those who are just starting out to those who have published multiple books. The Crime Wave takes place Friday and Saturday, and you can visit mainewriters.org to learn more about workshops and events. Well, welcome to all of you, and I want to ask you each about your personal stories and how you got into crime writing, but first I want to ask the big question, and Cheryl, I'll start with you. Okay. Why is crime so popular and has been so popular for such a long time? Why do you think human beings want to read stories about crimes, especially true crimes?
Mm-hmm. So I think even the nicest of us have wanted to kill somebody in the back of our mind, you know, you know, whether it's not Catherine, obviously, being cut off in traffic, because we've talked about that. But there's so many incidents during the day where you think in your mind, you don't really mean it, but you're going like, I wish I could kill you, you know, that kind of thing. So I think over the course of time, people have that instinct. I think it's human nature. And so when we see actual crime or read crime novels, we're kind of vicariously living that instinct out.
So you think we can all relate?
I do think we can all relate. Absolutely.
Okay. Catherine Miles, why do you think people are so drawn to the crime?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad we're not in studio, since Cheryl is apparently a latent murderer. So I'm glad that I'm calling into this call. I actually would take it from the exact opposite perspective. And I would say that I think for a lot of people, it's this idea of being able to picture yourself as a potential victim. And one of the things I did when I was researching Trailed was speak to people who are really active on discussion boards and listservs where they're trying to do this sort of citizen sleuthing of crimes. And what a lot of them said to me was that getting involved in these kind of true crime cases was a way that ultimately made them feel safer. If they could understand the motivations and the MOs of people who perpetrate violent crime, that they felt like it might be less likely that they themselves would become a victim.
So maybe having some control over the situation by understanding it.
Right. I think that's the knowledge is power idea.
Yeah. Okay, Kate, what about you? What do you think? Why do so many people like to read crime stories?
I don't know. Years ago, a librarian told me when I was doing a library event that what she thought was that the reason that people love to read crime novels is that they can have the vicarious thrill in the safety of their homes so that they can, you know, they can go through the whole process. There are people out there who absolutely love the puzzle solving piece of it. They like to try and figure it out before the end of the book. They like to outthink the author, outguess the author. And our job, of course, is to fool them till the end. And true crime, I think, is more like what Catherine said, that people are fascinated by the possibility of the danger out there. And in a way, by reading this or by watching these things on TV, getting a sense that maybe you could be better prepared.
It's interesting you say reading these in the safety of your own home, Kate, because suddenly your own home doesn't seem so safe if you're reading one of your books. Every noise, every light outside takes on a different meaning. I understand that pretty much everybody on this panel and everybody at the Crime Wave event this weekend is going to have a different story about how they came to crime writing. So I'm going to ask each of you the same thing. Cheryl, when did you first write your first crime story? And were you always going to do that? Were you a little girl thinking, when I grow up, I'm going to scare the pants off of people?
No, but I had my pants scared off by Edgar Allan Poe. And so I became fascinated with at least the storytelling around crime and mystery. And to Kate's point about puzzles, I've always been a puzzle solver. So I love that aspect of writing mysteries. But I'd written in 2014, I'd written a historical fiction piece about Negro soldiers in World War II. It was really quite a daunting task of research. I really had bitten off more than I could chew. 6 years later, when I finished that book, I was just so exhausted by the idea of writing it and the research that I thought I'd do something for fun, and that was to write a mystery, which just was so, that's such a pleasant event for me. So in 4 months, I wrote my very first mystery. I queried it with a couple of publishers. I probably didn't know what I was doing. Got tired of that process and self-published it on Amazon's new platform, and I was just so satisfied with myself. And then a publisher came across that story and asked if I would reform the story, and I started publishing mysteries right after that. That was book one of my Charlie Mack Motown mysteries.
You know, that's so interesting that you eventually self-published, and by self-publishing, a publisher found you. And that seems to be the route for a lot of authors these days, and really a little liberating, isn't it? That the traditional box has been pushed open a little bit.
It really has. I mean, and these platforms, these self-publishing platforms, really have democratized publishing in a way. And publishers are all over the internet and other platforms looking for short stories and larger stories and the potential of writers they see online. So it's really been, I think, a boon to the publishing industry that the big five don't have all the power anymore.
Catherine Miles, I've read several of your books, so I know that Trailed is not a traditional book for you. You do not consider yourself a crime writer, and this is the first true crime. It's not even a novel. This is the first true crime book you've written. How did you come to I don't know, changing directions?
Yeah, it's a question I still sort of ask myself. I started my career in a very sort of formal academic setting, and I was really interested in the relationship that people form or feel like they can't form with natural spaces and built environments. And so I've always been really interested about who we are and who we get to be in the world. And for me, I think, you know, increasingly working more as an investigative journalist, I've been finding myself sort of looking at the ways in which other types of forces, whether it's, you know, human influence, whether it's natural disaster or whatever, really impacts those relationships. And so As a journalist writing magazine articles, I had written several articles about violence that had occurred in the wilderness, which is a project and a topic that's really near and dear to my heart. And so I had assumed that Trailed was actually just going to be a 3,000 word magazine article. And once I started digging into the particular case and understanding the nuance and the complexity of it, I realized really quickly that 3,000 words wasn't going to be nearly enough. So now increasingly I find myself with these sorts of assignments that are dealing with issues of social justice, environmental justice, and how it is that we create this access for people in the wilderness and how we police the wilderness.
You know, and one of the big sort of subgenres of crime writing has become the podcast, the true crime podcast. And I understand, Catherine Miles, that Trailed is about to become a podcast.
No, a TV show, actually.
Oh, a TV show. Wow. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's been great. We've been working with a production company based in Canada and just signed a really dynamite young director to work on it. And I'm just so taken really by what's happening on these streaming platforms. I feel like increasingly it's where a number of people are going to find narratives that compel them. And so this re-education for me and learning the art of visual storytelling has just been really wonderful.
Kate Flora, 24 books, as I mentioned. What was the first one? And I'll ask you the same question I asked Cheryl. Did you grow up knowing you wanted to be a crime writer? Or is this something that happened to you in a circuitous way?
I did not know I wanted to be a crime writer. I knew I wanted to be a writer. You know, I was a dreamy child reading, you know, immersed in books on a chicken farm in Union. And I, you know, always thought that one of the things that writers could do, which was truly magical, was to transport us from our everyday worlds into the worlds that they had created. And I thought it was absolutely awesome that they can do that. I still do. I'm still just as big a fangirl as I am a writer. But I turned to reading crime novels mostly when I was studying for the bar. And it was, you know, it was sort of like what Cheryl said, you know, you wanted to rest, you've been doing hard work. And so I started reading, you know, mysteries a lot. And then one night I was walking on the beach in Bermuda and I said to my husband, I have an idea for a mystery. I then spent 10 miserable years in the unpublished writer's corner. And finally, you know, one day got the phone call on a icy December night, you know, you have sold your first book. That was a book called Chosen for Death. And it was the first book in my Thea Kozak series, and I just published the 12th. And so that was the beginning. And I thought then, and quite reasonably, I think, you know, you sort of have a career path. You say, okay, I'm giving up the law. I'm going to write mysteries. And I would write for 9 months and promote for 9 months. And then, I suddenly realized that I'd been spending an awful lot of my life with cops, and that their world interested me, which sort of led to a sideways segue into writing police procedurals and then on to true crime.
Mm. Cheryl, had you mentioned your Charlie Mack Motown mystery series, but I understand your most recent book is not one of those, but really based on your own grandfather's murder. Tell me the story and tell me why you decided to write about that instead of continuing with what you have been so popular for.
Yeah. Well, in 1929, my grandfather was killed by Birmingham, Alabama police. He and his wife, my grandmother and my mother, was 2 years old at the time, had moved from St. Petersburg, Florida to Birmingham. So my grandfather could work in the construction industry. It was a time of boom for Birmingham. They were called the Pittsburgh of the South at the time. Their steel industry was just on fire. And within months of my grandfather moving to Birmingham, he was killed by police officers. We didn't know a lot about that through my growing up, what had happened, very few details about that. My grandmother and mother were whisked away from Birmingham after that by their family, because those were times in Jim Crow South where Black people didn't really demand investigations of police actions or confront police about their actions. And so it was whispered a lot in our family, told in stories, some mythology, but lots of stories told over and over again through the decades as my grandmother and mother kept the story alive. So my mother and I had talked about writing this story a lot over the years, but it wasn't until the murder of George Floyd that I really felt compelled to tell this story, to take a try at telling the story, even without having all the details I thought I needed to write the story. I just thought now is the time to show the parallels between 2020 and the 1920s when my grandfather was killed. So took off on the tack of trying to write that story, really understood right away that it needed to be fictionalized. So it's set in two timelines, dual perspectives, a 1929 timeline in my grandfather's voice as he's living in Birmingham and working and experiencing his life. And then a 2019 timeline, just pre-COVID, where a young Black newspaper reporter convinces her editorial team that she should go back to Birmingham and investigate the details of her great-grandfather's death.
Is the reason that you fictionalized it because you knew you would never be able to uncover the details that you would need to tell it completely?
I'm pretty sure I couldn't write it as a memoir or my mom's memoir, not with sketchy memories and lack of facts. I just didn't want to do that. So the fictionalized part of it felt a way to take all the snippets of information I had about my father, every detail I know about him, every story I've heard about him, every memory my grandmother carried about him is in the book, but in a fictionalized way, because I didn't know my grandfather at all. I think I did justice to it because those parts of the story I wrote so organically after a tremendous amount of research about what 1929 Birmingham looked like, felt like, what was happening in the world in 1929 and what was happening in the United States in 1929. And so I scoured newspapers. That was my primary source of research to get that part of the story right. Black newspapers in particular helped me to really paint a vivid picture of segregated life in Jim Crow, Birmingham, Alabama. And so I knew it couldn't be a true crime story or a memoir, but I think I've told the story in a way that is accessible as crime fiction.
Cheryl, I'm imagining that must have been very difficult to research and write.
There were times when I was crying and writing. You know, I actually found a few documents my family never had over the 90 years since his death. I was able to secure his death certificate for the first time, which gave me a lot more detail about his injuries, his wounds. My grandmother was the complainant, which says to me that she had the courage at least to go to the police and say, "Why have you killed my husband?" I was able to find the death certificate because I ran across, after scores and scores and scores of hours after writing each day of going through newspaper archives, I found a 1-inch by 1-inch newspaper article with the headline, "Local Negro Killed by Birmingham Police." And that turned out to be my grandfather's story. It was printed in the St. Petersburg Times in August 1929.
We are speaking with well-known crime writers on Maine Calling today in advance of Crime Wave this weekend with the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. Tell us about crime stories that have stayed with you. Tell us about your attempts to write one. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email at talk@mainepublic.org or post on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Island Institute, helping Maine's island and coastal communities navigate change in our economy and climate. Join today, islandinstitute.org. And by Wyman's, committed to sustainably harvesting wild blueberries as a family business in Maine since 1874. Available in freezer aisles nationwide.
The vaquita, the world's smallest porpoise, is on the brink of extinction. But to save it, environmentalists and NGOs are up against Mexican cartels, lax government enforcement, and an international illegal fishing operation. we'll hear about the efforts to protect the vaquita and implement sustainable fishing practices next time on The Catch, a show from Foreign Policy.
And you can hear that broadcast this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. If you haven't yet joined our All Books Considered book club, there's still time to read our next selection, The Midcoast, the debut novel from Adam White. The Midcoast is a propulsive crime drama exploring the machinations of privilege and the dark recesses of the American dream. Our virtual book club meeting for The Midcoast will be held on Thursday evening, June 22nd. To sign up or to learn more, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about crime writing, fact-based and fictional. Joining me, three authors, each of whom brings a different take to the genre of crime writing. Cheryl Head is the author of the award-winning Charlie Mack Motown Mysteries. Her new book, Time's Undoing, is based in part on her grandfather's murder at the hands of police in 1929. Catherine Miles' book, Trailed, won the 2023 Maine Literary Award for nonfiction and was a finalist for an Edgar Award in the Best Fact Crime category. And Kate Flora's Joe Burgess Police Procedurals won the Maine Literary Award for crime fiction. Her true crime stories include Finding Amy and Death Dealer. Share your comments and questions. What do you want to know about crime writing? Send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. For this next question, I'll start with you, Kate Flora. What makes a good crime novel? Does it have to be a murder? And does it have to be solved?
If you were asking me about true crime, I could have a different answer. But I would say that the answer to that is, in general, the genre requires that there is a murder. There are a few out there where there are not murders, but it's sort of, you know, we write to readers' expectations, and that is that it is going to be, that there's going to be a murder, and that's the propulsion, the propulsive event, which gives rise to either an amateur or a professional investigator to go and solve the crime. Does it have to be solved? Again, the answer is in general. It is fun to every once in a while have a situation, as I did in my first Joe Burgess book, where the which is called Playing God, where the crime is solved, we know who did it, but she has somehow slipped away into the ether. In a way, it's a book in which you become immensely sympathetic to the criminal, to the perpetrator. And in a way, you know, we know that Joe will catch her someday, but for now it's okay with us as readers that she is in fact gone. Which is interesting, because in general, yes, we're supposed to solve the crime and catch the bad guy, because sort of one of the underlying things that causes people to read these books is that they're essentially moral books. They are books in which the world is made right. Bad guys are caught, crimes are punished. There is, you know, very often quite a heroic aspect to the investigator, whether amateur or professional. And that, you know, that there's a way in which that makes readers feel very comfortable. They're comforted to know that crimes get solved and bad guys get punished.
Yeah. And even though that doesn't happen always in real life. You
know? Exactly. Yeah. And we know plenty about the situation in real life. And, you know, you've lived it. So.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about, Cheryl, as you were talking about your grandfather's murder, I was thinking about an interview I read about with Tess Gerritsen, where she said after the George Floyd murder that she's rethinking the way that she always squarely portrays police as the good guys, and that she took a pause from writing. And that is sort of a really, I guess, question of the times. I mean, we think of all, especially the TV shows over the years, but also these crime novels where the police detective is often the hero, the police detective who works late into the night and sees things in a different way. And yet now the police detective or the police officer may be the person who committed the crime.
And, you know, and I love that trope of the heroic detective and the heroic police officer. And that's been part of the classic noir tradition. And I love noir over everything else. But I do think that we have to be thinking all of that. I think our world is so complex, and it's not always easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys as easily as it had been. I'm thinking with Catherine, the Golden Gate murderer, that serial killer who was a police officer for over decades had been killing people. It really is troubling to me in a way, because I think, as Kate mentioned, people read crime fiction to suss out how justice is delivered. And we all want that. We really desperately all want to see justice served. But more and more, we're seeing really popular crime shows like Killing Eve and the protagonist Villanelle, who is so delightfully enticing and charming, but she's a serial killer. And yet I was watching it and rooting for her. So I don't know what that says about me.
Yeah, well, you producers, you do that on purpose, don't you? You mess with our heads. Catherine, I want to talk about, building off this whole conversation about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, how crime, whether it's fiction or true crime, can comment on social issues without commenting on social issues. How, by just following a plot and following an investigation, you can talk about something bigger.
Right. And that's always been something that's been near and dear to my heart. With this particular book, Trailed, the crime in question was named the first official U.S. federal hate crime. The two victims were in a same-sex relationship. And whether or not this actually kind of fit the definition of hate crime is something that I explore in the book. But this idea of hate crime, I think, and really sort of targeting someone because of their social identity is I think something we need to talk a lot about. The other thing that I call attention to in the book is this notion of confirmation bias, which we all suffer from, but is particularly insidious, I think, when law enforcement fall prey to it. And that's this idea that once we have an idea or a theory in our head, we tend to sort of filter all information through that idea. So if, as an investigator, I have a suspect in mind, I think he or she is the perpetrator, I'm going to then start building a case around that person, often to the exclusion of others who may or may not be the actual actors involved. And I think that we see this a lot more than I think some law enforcement officials would like to admit. I think it's why we have 250,000 cold cases in this country, and the overwhelming number of those victims are people and often women of color. And so kind of understanding those sorts of things, understanding how it is that we get to wrongful convictions or unsolved cases is, I think, something that would probably behoove all of us to take a real look at.
Catherine was talking about confirmation bias. Kate, earlier you were talking about tricking the reader. I'm guessing that that's a really, confirmation bias is a convenient way to, you can play on the reader's confirmation bias in tricking them into who actually committed the crime.
Is that a question for me?
Yeah. I mean, have you done that?
I'm sitting there just being so mesmerized by the conversation, I forget to respond.
I guess what I'm asking is that one of the sort of devices you might use? And then maybe what are some other devices you might use to trick that reader?
Oh my goodness. There's lying, why do people lie? Lying is probably the best one. Because as David Simon said in Homicide, everybody lies. People lie for a lot of different reasons. And so one of the things that, if your character is a homicide detective, or if your character is an amateur detective and you go and talk to people, people will lie to you. And one of the things that we do all the time in crime novels is to look at the ways that we use those lies. They're lying about the timeline. They're lying about where they were. They're lying about their relationships. They're lying about their feelings. They're lying about absolutely everything. And so, for the reader, really, I guess the question that we're posing is, which lies matter? Mm-hmm. And which lies don't matter. And, right. And that lets us play a shell game with facts and time. There are, as you probably know, about 15 different answers to your question. And, right. Me, the talking head, I can't be shut up. So.
And I'm thinking about the unreliable narrator kind of trend now in some of the books that kind of started with Gone Girl, Girl on a Train, where you unlike the older classics, the Agatha Christie's, where you trust Miss Marple and her narration, and you trust Poirot and their narration. You're not always sure now if the person's voice that you're hearing as the narrator of that book is on the level or not. I kind of like that trope. I think it turns mysteries on its head.
I think that playing with assumptions. My newest book is what we call a domestic thriller or domestic suspense. Yeah. And it's a story about a school teacher who is accused of having an affair with a 16-year-old student. And all of the assumptions that the public's going to make are that, of course, she did it. And nobody's assumptions are going to be that this is actually an obsessed and diabolical 16-year-old who has been stalking her and creating a fantasy in his mind about what's actually going on, so that he sounds incredibly plausible when he describes this affair that didn't take place. And the lies just keep going and going and going until she's beginning to say, I know I didn't do it, and yet.
Okay, Kate, you're talking about your new plot. Makes me think, where do they come from and how do you look at the world? Are you sitting in the bus station? Are you sitting in the coffee shop? Are you going on a walk in your neighborhood thinking diabolical things about your neighbors and strangers? Cheryl, you're laughing. You are, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, we crime fiction people are not the best people to have for friends, you know, because when I'm doing dog walking, I'll go by a place and I'm like, wow, that's a great place for a murder. Let me make a note of that, you know. Or if you're in a coffee shop, you're looking at somebody and you're thinking, I'm such a, you know, I've become so skeptical of human nature. So I'm always attuned for what could be wrong in this situation. I can't read the newspaper without having 50 ideas for a novel. You know, I mean, today's Washington Post had a story about a man being attacked by bees from 3 hours and living. And I thought, there might be a story in that. And then yesterday we had a sonic boom because some fighter jets shot down a pilot in a plane. I'm very skeptical of that story. I'm going like, I do not believe anything the law enforcement people are saying about this, you know. So we just walk around, I think, with this cynicism about.
Oh my goodness! Would you agree, Kate? Are you that cynical?
Oh, I have a clipping on my refrigerator, which is a pulmonary specialist who dies at home of an asthma attack, and the story says that she couldn't find her inhaler. And everything is like that.
Yes.
We walk. I describe writers as going through life like pieces of blotting paper.
Yes.
And we just absorb it.
Catherine Miles, what is there a newspaper clip on your refrigerator?
No, but I'm eager to hear both more about these. You know, for me, you know, really as a journalist, I'm always take really seriously this idea of the fourth estate, the idea that journalists can police the police. And so I'm always sort of taking that watchdog kind of approach, like, where does some inquiry need to be happening? And I'm also always just looking for that narrative that gets us all to think about the world in a different way, that story that we haven't heard before that has a twist to it, and that voice that we haven't heard before. And if I can give voice to someone else's story, I feel like I'm doing a good job.
Hmm. We're going to go to the call. Important. Oh, go ahead, Cheryl.
I was just going to say, I think that's so important what Catherine says about journalism. The pure J, capital J journalism, it still is our one firewall between the chaos and the order.
Yeah.
We're going to go to the phones. Gibson is calling from Portland. Is this Gibson Fay LeBlanc with the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance?
It sure is. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for hosting these three great writers. It's great to hear the conversation. And I just wanted to mention that for the Maine Crime Wave, Friday night, we're doing a couple different events that are free and open to the public. So there's rooms for folks to show up. It starts at 5 o'clock at USM at the Glickman Library. And then Saturday, the panel that these three are on, or actually two out of the three, and then Kate's on some other stuff, will be all day. There'll be panels happening all day Saturday. Folks do need to register, and they can check out our website if they want to do that.
Okay, thanks for calling in, Gibson. Before we let you go, do you have a favorite crime book, either true crime or fiction?
Oh, so many. I am a big fan of Louise Penny.
Yes.
And read and listened to many of those. And then I also just, I haven't actually listened to it yet, but I just picked up the new F.A. Cosby novel. I think it's called All the Sinners Bleed. Yeah, I've read a lot about him, and he seems like he's doing some really interesting work.
And Gibson, where can people find out more about the crime wave this weekend?
They can just go to mainwriters.org and they'll see it there.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. We are going to take another quick break. What are your questions for these crime writers? We are going to ask them for some tips. We are going to ask them what their favorite authors are. But first, our number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email if you're quick, talk@mainpublic.org, or find us on social media. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Waypoint Brokers Collective, real estate with a commitment to sustainability, waypointbrokers.com. And by Folia in Portland's Old Port, where you'll find jewelry by Maine designers, as well as custom design and repair services. FoliaJewelry.com.
I'm Scott Tong. In Chicago, shelters are full, so hundreds of migrants are sleeping in police stations.
Right there in the front of the stations, you have people laying on bare, hard floors, some with blankets or sleeping bags, women, children, families.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us. Here and Now upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of the Camden Opera House's Jazz in June series, happening June 16th and 17th. The series includes a wide variety of daytime outside performances, evening concerts at the Camden Opera House, and receptions at local hotspots. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets for the Jazz in June concerts. For complete details, please visit mainepublic.org. And click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. And today we're talking about crime writing. With me, Kate Flora, author and recovering attorney, who was raised on a chicken farm in Maine. She is the author of 24 mystery and nonfiction books. Catherine Miles is the author of 5 books, including Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders, which won the 2023 Maine Literary Award for Nonfiction. And Cheryl Head's new book, Time's Undoing, is based on her grandfather's murder at the hands of police in 1929. Do you have a favorite crime novel or true crime book or podcast? Join our conversation. Send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. Post a comment on social media or call 1-800-399-3566. Cheryl Head, if somebody is listening to this organization, this conversation and thinking, I want to try that. That sounds like fun. I've got all sorts of ideas. What are your tips? What are your tips for first-time mystery authors?
You know, just do it. Just start writing. Just start writing long if you've got ideas. Put pen to paper, get on the laptop and start writing. And I hear people all the time say, I want to write a book. And I go like, what's stopping you? Just start writing. You know, the other tip I would give is find a writing community, 2 or 3 friends who can support you in the effort, maybe other writers, emerging writers, so you can critique each other's works and give each other attagirls and encouragement, because it can be a lonely endeavor, and imposter syndrome seeps in all the time.
And Catherine, speaking of a writing community, we just heard from Gibson Faye LeBlanc. Maine has an unusually robust writing community, doesn't it?
It's just so wonderful. And, you know, this can be such a solitary pursuit, and especially if you're dealing with really, you know, potentially emotionally charged materials like crime. It's so wonderful to be a part of community. And, you know, Gibson took an already spectacular organization and made it even better. And between their classes and their workshops and conferences like this weekend's Crime Wave, it really is such a treasure for everyone in the state of Maine.
Kate, what's your tip for a first-time crime writer?
Well, I think I follow right on what Cheryl said. You have to put your seat in the seat and you have to stay there. Very often people have come up to me at various events and they say, I've always wanted to write, And someday when I have a free weekend, I'm going to write my novel. And I think, yeah, and I'm, you know, always wanted to be a brain surgeon. And sometime when I have a free weekend, I am going to, you know, study brain surgery and do it on Monday. It's hard and it's lonely. And that's why I have to echo what, you know, Catherine said about community. One of the best communities that I have had the privilege of belonging to is Sisters in Crime, which is, you know, an international organization of writers, which was founded to support women writers. And there's always people there, you know, that you can go to for advice and expertise and find a group and so forth. But it is solitary, but it's also solitary because that's where you have to be in order to get the work done.
We'll go to Penny, who's calling from Bristol. Hi, Penny, go ahead.
Hi, I apologize for my laryngitis. I was delighted to hear someone mention Louise Penny, who's one of my triumvirate of favorites, the other being Deborah Crombie and Julia Spencer Fleming. And I love that they know each other and support each other, which I know from their acknowledgments. But my question is, whatever happened to Julia Spencer Fleming? She just seemed to disappear. And her main character is still pregnant and still wandering around trying not to get killed. And does anyone know?
I would suggest that you could come to the Crime Wave this weekend and Julia will be there and you can ask her yourself.
Okay.
She's working on a new book. There have been a lot of ups and downs in her life, and she takes her time writing those books, but they are so worth it when she's finished. And she's wonderful to listen to because she so beautifully blends life story with craft.
Yes, I've met her a couple of times at the Damascotta bookstore, and she is lovely to talk to and very interesting person. Well, thank you for that information. And this is a terrific program. I'm just so glad I turned it on.
Well, thank you, Penny, for calling in. We have an email here from Sydney. I loved Dorothy Sayers. Have read them all. Lord Peter Death Breeden Whimsey was a lovely Englishman. We named our first sailboat Whimsey. Spelling may be wrong. And then from Megan, Vicky Dudera in Camden, Maine, a realtor and author, wrote several fiction novels, the Darby Farr mysteries. Also Sarah Graves, the old house related. They are great reads for anyone interested in old houses in Maine. And then Megan adds, my fridge news article references an elderly Polish woman who was succumbed by fumes while stirring her sauerkraut barrel and then drowned. That's a good one, Megan. We'll see if anybody can top that. We'll go to Michael calling from Portland. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How are you? Good show today. A couple things. First is I read once where Hemingway started every book by cleaning out the refrigerator, meaning it's very difficult to begin a new book, whether it comes from an idea or, you know, chicken and the egg. Is he inspired by a, you know, particular thought? So the first part would be, how do you guys begin a book? And then secondarily, I wanted to plug an author named John Conley, who has a series of fiction crime based on a private investigator named Charlie Parker. And all of the crimes take place in Maine. The character Charlie Parker is actually a bartender at the Great Lost Bear. So there's a lot of Maine tie-ins, and he really writes beautifully about Maine. So definitely wanted to plug John Conley, who's also a hell of a guy. Based out of Ireland, but spends a lot of time here in Maine. So question is, how do you guys begin a new book?
Michael, thanks for the question. Cheryl, I'll start with you.
Well, I usually get inspiration from either something I've read in the newspaper, or in the case of my last book in the Charlie Mack series, it was actually something I heard on Maine Public Radio 3 years ago when I was up in Brooklyn, Maine. I heard a defense contractor come on and talk about an FBI report that had now been open to the public that looked at the numerous attempts against Barack Obama's life. And I remember thinking, there's something I can do with that piece of information. Then fast forward 3 years later, and there is a conspiracy to kill the governor of Michigan. These are true facts. And I put those two things together and wrote my last book, which is called Warn Me When It's Time, about the nascent beginnings of hate groups in America. So that's where the ideas came from.
Boy, another. And how did you actually start writing? Did you do something like clean out the refrigerator? Do you have, well, or are you like a baseball batter adjusts your gloves?
It makes a lot of sense to me. My best ideas come either in the shower, traveling on a train, or digging in the garden.
Okay, Catherine, what about you?
I love that refrigerator quote. I told one of my graduate students that he was a real writer when he texted me and he told me he was procrastinating and washing his floor instead of finishing his thesis. And I said, you've arrived. So yeah, my house is really clean when I'm stuck. But for me, the issue is always, what's the size and the shape of a piece? Is it a 1,000-word story? Is it a 5,000-word story? Is it a 90,000-word book? And I think those are hard questions for us to answer sometimes. I think a lot of us immediately go to book-length projects, but I think some of these stories work really well as much smaller things. So understanding, I think, how much there is to really say, I think is a first step for every writer.
Kate?
Well, you know, every book is different. Some of them come from a situation. Some of them come from a character. Some of them come from a question. But my latest Thea Kozak mystery, which is called Death Sends a Message, was interesting to me because I've been working with this character, Thea, for many, many years. And this is the 12th book. And for a long, long time, what I've said is, as a writer, you can never allow your character to have a baby, because if your character has a baby, how are they going to go a sleuthing? And having, you know, developed this relationship with her husband, a Maine State Trooper, they have a baby. And then I am faced with the awful, awful problem of how does she solve a mystery when she's home with a newborn? And it was probably the worst writing challenge that I've ever faced. And I hope that I pulled it off. But really an interesting thing to think about. You can't just go around asking people questions. How are you going to do it?
Michael, thanks for the good question. Kate, you could put the baby in a backpack or a baby Bjorn and go out into the crime scene, can't you?
You probably could, but this is a newborn. I mean, you know, they're pretty fragile.
Okay. An email here from Sandra. Research is difficult for me. I would like to know how other authors do their research. Is it just by internet? Do people still look through microfiche at the library? Cheryl, did you travel to Birmingham and go through microfiche?
No, I had been to Birmingham many times before. I did go through microfiche here in Washington, D.C., where I have the wonderful resource of the Library of Congress, you know. So yes, research is hard. There are lots of different ways to do it now because of digital archives. Thank goodness we don't always have to travel someplace to see a letter where it resides. I do a lot of newspaper archival work through newspapers.com. I do a lot of Google mapping. Sometimes I'll do Google mapping just to get a sense of a place if I haven't been there. I read a lot of letters. I think letters are a really good entryway into character-driven plots. A lot of maps, those kinds of things. But it is very daunting and hard. And usually when I do something like that that requires a lot of research, I give myself a break and write a story that doesn't require as much research.
All right. And Catherine, I know that you do travel because part of Trailed is your journey.
And I'll admit, I love the research and I'll do anything to avoid starting the writing. And so if I can dig into some kind of archive, I'm a much happier person than if I have to put pen to paper. And, you know, with Trailed, I had the wonderfully sort of unusual experience of having the opportunity to pair with the Innocence Project. And because the case that I was working on was a federal case that had gone to pre-trial hearings in a courthouse, that meant that all of the evidence was exchanged through a process called discovery. And so once I was able to start working with the Innocence Project attorneys, I had access to boxes and boxes and boxes of evidence that normally a writer or a journalist wouldn't have for an open case. And so that was both a wonderful problem and also a really daunting problem to figure out, how do you condense 23 boxes of material into a 90,000 word narrative. So that's where the challenge comes in for me.
And Kate, I know that you are friends with many police officers. I'm taking it that a lot of your research starts with conversations.
Yeah, I find that, you know, partly because we do spend so much time in our rooms alone, the opportunity to get out, to sit down with someone and to ask your questions, you get so much more. You get, you know, when I'm sitting in a police department and I'm talking to a detective, I've got the world around him. I've got what's on people's desks. I've got the background chatter. I've got other people's interactions. But also I build a relationship that lets me, gives me access to a world that's traditionally very much sort of siloed and very much, you know, it's us versus them. You're a civilian. And when I can get past that barrier, I get just genuinely extraordinary information. So that if I'm talking to a state police detective and I'm saying to him for Finding Amy, what was it like the night that you were out in the woods digging up the body? And he starts to talk about the smells and the color and people's gloves and the Klieg lights. And the, you can't duplicate that with online research or reading a book. You just can't come anywhere near close to the stories that people tell that illuminate a world.
And Jennifer, could I add that just for my two historical fiction books, they were oral histories that really helped me to write those books. As Kate says, the language that comes from the witness, from the first person witness, it's just invaluable.
Michael in Scarborough is calling in. Michael, if you could be super quick, that would be great.
Hi there. Thank you for this lovely program. I just was curious if and how writing has become a channel for your own personal and spiritual healing.
I'll go back to Cheryl with that. Has writing your most recent book helped you heal?
Obviously it has. I started writing it in rage. I knew I was enraged. I was walking through the house yelling and my partner was looking at me, paced back and forth. Then I started writing the next day. And it was a cathartic experience. By the time I wrote the end, the rage was gone. I felt relief. For my mother, who I did a lot of oral histories with, she actually is in a place of forgiveness. I'm not quite there yet.
Michael, thank you for your question. And I promised my audience that I would ask you for your favorite crime authors. Kate, I'm going to start with you.
Well, you know, they're all my friends, right? So it's hard to, you know, it's like choosing your favorite child. But I would say, since we're talking Maine and we're talking longtime Maine writers, that I would put Jerry Boyle way at the top of my list. I think he has both a talent for description and a talent for creating an atmosphere of fear, of anxiety, of threat. That is superb.
And Jerry Boyle, wonderful. And Catherine and Cheryl, I'm going to ask you to say it real fast because we're getting close to the end. Who will you throw out there for us, Catherine?
Sure. I have two memoirs, actually. I'm really committed to books that really foreground victims and victim experiences. And two memoirs that do that are Lacey Crawford's Notes on a Silencing and Terry Jentz's Strange Piece of Paradise, two crime survivors who are writing about their experience.
Thank you. Cheryl, your turn.
And I'm just going to throw out the name of an organization, the Crime Writers of Color, a 300-member group of people of color who are writing mysteries in a new way. It's fascinating and exciting and wonderful work.
Well, thank you all for being here. The voice you just heard, Cheryl Head, and the book we've been talking about, Time's Undoing, Catherine Miles' most recent book, Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. Stumbling there. Kate Flora. Her true crime stories include Finding Amy and Death Dealer. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.